So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to Review Man.
Ladies and gentlemen, the following contest, scheduled for one fall, is the special bra and panties mud match.
Shut up, Coward Howard. Get the puppies out here. Oh, you gotta be kidding me. Legs of hers up right outside.
Here they go. Wait a minute.
It's a roll up. And Trish wins it.
Here is your winner, Trish Stratton.
Trish wins the bronze panties match. Well, General Manager Bischoff.
Oh, I see a ball.
Met a girl, thought she was grand. Fell in love, found out firsthand. Went well for a week or two. Then it all came unglued. In a trip I can't grip.
Hello and welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting with you. And this way is like our Lord of the Rings. And this would be... What was the first one
the
called?
The Fellowship of the Ring.
Okay, this is the Fellowship of the Roth. Then we'll have...
You can use the ring.
For the SmackDown well. Towers, all leading up to Return of the Heartbreak Kid at SummerSlam 2002.
Oh, so lame.
Yeah.
We said that's...
No play on words. Nothing. Just butchering.
And what would be the prequel? The Hobbit? What would that be?
Well, Daniel Bryan, I guess... Training at Shawn Michaels' gym, getting him ready for this match.
Let's start this podcast over.
No. This is really great stuff.
Really bad.
This is really brilliant. I guess we got to do a 3-hour show today.
Why?
The Fellowship of the Ring.
Oh, right.
They're all
long. I never watched those movies. I tried to sit through the first one. I couldn't, man.
They're too long. I saw them all in the theater. Too long. Way too long.
I know people, like, before The Hobbit came out, they were doing, like, marathons where you could watch all three. In one go?
Yeah.
I'm like, what? How could you do anything for that amount of time?
I think it's insane. Like, I can barely stay in a theater past the 2-hour mark. That's like when I'm getting, like, antsy to get up and leave. I just want a movie to end at that point. The idea of just going back to watch, like, one of those 3-plus-hour movies, makes me just fearful.
I miss intermissions. Not that I necessarily knew what it was like back when they had intermissions during movies, but I mean...
There's a reason for them.
Yeah.
If for nothing else, go buy some shit. Go buy popcorn and stuff. It's advantageous for the movie theaters to do intermissions.
Yeah.
I've never gone to a movie that had an intermission, have you?
Only drive-ins, but no, not even. Like, the intermissions would be just between the movies.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Actually, that's not true. You know that, I'm sure there's like a Tarantino movie that had like a fake intermission.
Yeah. There was that like double bill that they were...
Yeah, Death Proof.
Yes, that was it. I never saw that.
Yeah. Oh, it was good.
How have you been since we talked on Monday night?
Fine. I've just been so tired. Like, just even watching this wrestling, this Raw. It was a good show, but I felt so tired by the end of it.
Do you think we'll ever go back and review a 3-hour edition of Raw?
I mean, it's still pretty recent, so it would have to be, like, you know, maybe in 5 years, maybe.
See, I like going back and reviewing these shows because it's like, yeah, it was 2 hours, but with commercials, that's like 40 minutes right there gone.
Yep.
It's like an hour and 20 minutes. That's, you know, two sittings, maybe if you're in a good mood, one.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
Yeah.
Did you watch this whole thing Monday night after 3 hours of Raw?
I watched most of it, and then I saved maybe like half an hour for right before. Yeah, I was just losing. I even started to lose interest an hour in. So that's when I.
So Raw was still too long 11 years ago.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
How's your black eye? It seems that there's still remnants of it.
Yeah, it's kind of getting worse before it gets better, but I mean, it feels fine.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
What was going on in your life in 2002?
I was in high school. I was a big wrestling fan. This was during my phase where I would record all these shows.
Oh, wow.
And I would tape those tapes.
Was this the SMC era?
Yeah, it was, actually.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So I would tape those.
Some people think the SMC could save TNA. I hear these rumors. Okay. I got to scour.
I don't think so. But
a lot of people talking about the SMC.
Yeah, no, I was a big wrestling fan at this time. And, you know, that's what I was doing. That was sort of my thing.
Yeah. I worked at a movie theater at this point. This is when I had all these friends that were really into wrestling, even at this point, even after kind of the boom period of such. I mean, this was kind of past that. But when the brand extension first began, I thought it was kind of launched a little. It's like it wasn't a big split in the company. It was just a brand extension. Mm-hmm. Like what a shitty corporate term to give to what the focus of this entire company is going to be.
It's not a split. It's an extension.
Yeah, we are going to diversify the portfolio. That's basically what they told us. Yeah. Oh shit, diversifying shit. This is going to totally up their stock. Yeah, fans were just loving this. And it was like, man, there were so many interesting ways you could have divided this company. And what did you think of the brand extension when it first happened? Was this something you were intrigued by?
Absolutely, it was. I mean, you know, this had come immediately, or not long after WrestleMania 18, which you and I both attended.
Not together, though.
No, not together.
Wouldn't it have been funny if we had been, like, just a few rows apart or something?
We might have ran into you through the hallways or something.
Maybe.
But, you know, it was a few weeks after that. And clearly, at this point, the invasion had just occurred. They had a surplus of talent and also a real lack of existing competition that I think even at that point they were noticing was was detrimental to the product. So to split the two brands, I was really intrigued. I thought, you know, it was something that I think everybody was seeing was starting to be a problem, is that there's too many people on these shows, not enough TV time to focus on everybody. So I think as a fan, I thought it was a good idea. And I was very interested, especially when they, you know, announced that draft, how they would split the brands, how they would split all these teams, all these people, and how they would differentiate the two shows.
Yeah, I was really intrigued by the draft and stuff and how they set it up. And I think for a lot of fans, they were just coming off this horribly botched invasion storyline. And it was like, man, you had WCW, you had ECW. And I think it was like, well, they fucked that up. But this is like, the WWE is now going to split into two, and they're going to create their own Monday Night War, but with Raw versus SmackDown. And I think people had high hopes that that would be the goal here, to create that Raw Nitro environment again. But now you're using your own guys. You're going to split them off. There'll be, you know, you're not going to see pairings anymore of certain guys and stuff. So I think there was a lot of interest. And I think we'd both agree that the first year of the brand extension was the strongest of all of the years before it. And I wouldn't even say it was anywhere close to, I think, what expectations were, but where they tried to keep things separate. There wasn't just people randomly popping up on shows. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like they were at least trying to give you the illusion of competition, even if it was all under the WWE umbrella.
It was a point where they were probably most devoted to the concept before they decided to just give in to, you know, maybe lack of interest in each individual show without a John Cena on both shows and just cave into, I guess, you know, wanting to put their top guys on both shows. But certainly, I really enjoyed this era, mainly for SmackDown, because SmackDown
was the loaded show.
Yeah.
If you're a fan of just wrestling, and to me, they had the more interesting characters, the better matches. SmackDown was, I think 2002 was the best year in SmackDown's history.
I agree. I mean, that was, you know, not immediately after SummerSlam, actually, but even prior to this, like, you had all the great workers on that show. You had Eddie, you had Ray, you had Chris Benoit, Edge, soon you would have Brock Lesnar as an exclusive. So a lot of the top, you know, some great wrestling, Kurt Angle, a lot of the top guys, the storylines were good too. Raw, on the other hand, was more of your sports entertainment program centered around, you know, Bischoff leading the way, and also the Divas division, the hardcore division, which by that point
was... It was all the stale, cliched nothing. Stuff that yeah. they were trying to get out of, but it was like, yeah, Raw was very much... clinging to the Attitude Era, and we'd see that later in the year with the HLA, the necrophilia. It was just really just spitballing stuff and seeing what would work, whereas SmackDown was just kind of the wrestling show. And I mean, they had the cruiserweights. Heyman would start writing SmackDown, I think, right after this, and it was just, at least if you can say nothing else, it was both shows were different. And it wasn't just trying to meld them yeah. into WWE, which is what they would become. But that was one of the start. Even if the difference was good and bad,
yeah.
which I felt it was at the time in 2002. So anyway, we should also mention, for those that maybe weren't watching at this point, it was when they drafted each wrestler to whether it be Raw or SmackDown, the only people that could cross over, I believe it was the WWE champion, and I think the women's champion...
Yes,
I think those were the only two that were allowed to go onto each show. And it was kind of tough because you would be building up the challenger on one brand, but the champion you'd want on both shows. So whichever show...
What did they do for the tag titles? Was that exclusive?
I think the tag titles were exclusive at the time because later they would introduce the SmackDown would get their own tag titles yeah. and yeah. do that big tournament with all the tag teams they had that fall. So those were kind of the only two that could go back and forth. Did you like that idea of having the champion be able to appear on both shows?
It was a rational idea in concept, but when you put it into execution, it soon became apparent that it was very difficult to build storylines with, let's say, Undertaker was champion, but his opponent wasn't on SmackDown. How do you build towards the pay-per-view by doing that? So at some point, they realized that it had become pointless. It makes sense for them to try, but in execution, it obviously didn't work.
They tried so many different things, too. It was like there were some months where they were building up to the title match and say it was the SmackDown guy challenging on Raw. Like, they wouldn't even acknowledge SmackDown or any of the storylines going on there. They realized on the go-home show they would have to at least throw to the announcers and they'd do a rundown
yeah.
for that part. But it was always... It was very difficult to execute.
Yeah, and a lot of trial and error came into play. I commend them for doing everything they can to kind of make the shows differently. Like, setting the announcers in different positions. Like on Raw, you would have JR and Lawler up by the entrance ramp where, the Nitro used to, put
their
guys.
Which
made
sense with kind of Bischoff as the figurehead on Raw, kind of crafting it after Nitro.
Little details like that. But in the end though, I think none of it really, made much of a difference.
No.
It really just kind of came across as them trying really hard to make something different that really isn't all that different.
Now, we had no idea when we picked this show. It was the Raw going into SummerSlam that year. The SummerSlam, it's gotten the most votes from people on our message board of the event they wanted us to review this summer. So that was our pick, and we thought we'd go with the Raw and the SmackDown because of the separation at this time. I think it's cool to watch both shows going into it. Taking place way in Norfolk.
Norfolk, yes, which our friend Nate Milton.
Unbelievable. We're going to review two shows from Norfolk
this week. The site of Hardcore Justice as well. Yeah, Norfolk. I'm obsessed with saying it now.
I don't think I could say Norfolk ever again.
No way.
Yeah, that feels so uninformed now that we've gotten into the Norfolk culture.
Norfolk, yeah. Isn't Norfolk
it?
Off.
Yeah. I didn't even realize it was Nate Milton's birthday earlier this week.
Yes. Happy belated birthday.
Happy birthday to yep. Nate. He gets to celebrate by going to Hardcore Justice.
What better birthday gift?
They teased taking away the Aces and Eights main event Mafia match, but it's going to air now next week after promoting this for, 3 weeks?
Yeah, so, I wonder why.
Yeah, we don't have time for it. It's going to be on next week's
I'm
show.
Sure they're going to explain it in storyline, maybe Saban will join the team or something.
So there we go. Raw from Norfolk.
Yeah, we should give some context, a bit more context about the time. I mean, where was Steve Austin's situation?
Oh, right. Austin, of course, back in, I think it was late May, he went on Bite This, and he was very upset about the creative at the time. And Bite This was, I mean, it was kind of like a company show, but they would talk about real issues and stuff like that from time to time. And especially if a guest like Austin comes on and wants to talk like that, he's going to. So he had had the problems at first, if you remember, right after WrestleMania. He had the match with Scott Hall. It was, you know, no one wanted to see Steve Austin and Scott Hall at WrestleMania. It was a real waste of Steve Austin, in my opinion. And he left after that.
Austin, actually, on his podcast with Scott Hall recently, he said that he had never gone back to watch that match, even to this day.
It wasn't a good match. Yeah. And the idea was that, you know, originally they wanted Scott Hall to beat Austin on that show. And Austin was like, I think very rightly so, was, listen, we don't even know what we're going to have with Scott Hall. And sure enough, that guy was gone within 2 months after that show. So anyway, that was his first kind of hiatus. He left for 2 weeks, went home, wasn't on TV, and then they did the draft. And I think it was the week after the draft, like the first Raw under the whole brand extension, that Austin showed up and they teased where he was going to go and they cemented him as the Raw guy. Did some programs, and then they wanted, after he did that Bite This interview complaining about the creative, they wanted to have Brock Lesnar beat him on Raw. This would have been pretty much right before the King of the Ring tournament. So they were getting ready to start the big summer of building up Brock Lesnar, and they thought, well, let's beat Austin on Raw. And they weren't going to promote it. It was just going to be, they were going to throw it out on Raw, maybe give it a day or two, advertise it ahead of time. And Austin was like, that's stupid. I shouldn't be losing to Lesnar on TV. I mean, that should be the SummerSlam match, if nothing else. Mm-hmm. So the idea was that Austin was not going to show up at Raw, ended up walking out on the company.
He took his ball.
And they covered this thing, and that was the turn. He took his ball and went home. And The Rock came back like a week or two before he was supposed to and infamously said, Austin took his ball and went home, but for me, this is home.
Oh, God.
Brought a tear to my eye. Yeah. And so that was kind of set up the whole summer. Austin was gone. He actually got arrested during that summer. Domestic violence. Got divorced from Deborah. Mm-hmm. Not a great year for one Steve Austin. So that's what was going on with him. And then Lesnar was pretty much the big project that summer, because if you recall, Austin was out. Rock was going to be leaving after the summer. Triple H actually got hurt at the beginning of the summer, and that kind of affected why he didn't wrestle at the July pay-per-view, and they were going to do the Michaels match anyway. But they needed to create a star, and Lesnar was their chosen one.
And Hogan, at this point, had his big match with The Rock at WrestleMania, was given a title run shortly after that. And what happened to him?
They went into the summer, and that was a SmackDown that we should check out one of these weeks, because I remember that so well. Mm-hmm. It was Lesnar beating Hogan clean on SmackDown, which, as you look back now, from Hogan's point of view, I mean, a very smart political move, but one that didn't really pan out for him, was he did that, A, with the idea that he would get his win back over Lesnar later that year when he came back. That was kind of the original plan for the Survivor Series. But on top of that, here's Austin, who walks out, takes his ball, and Hogan doesn't play the same game and is like, yeah, I'll put him over. I mean, I think a smart move on Hogan's part.
He's got a basketball. Austin had a football.
Maybe there was only one ball to go around.
Yeah, he had a puck.
Hogan didn't have a ball to take home.
Yeah.
So Hogan just got laid out on SmackDown, beat clean by Lesnar. And to me, that win was really significant.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not too many TV matches that really stand out to you, but that image of Lesnar, Hogan was all bloody. He wiped the blood on his chest. One of the lasting memories I have of SmackDown and Hogan, even if his intentions were, well, I'm going to beat this fucker at the end of all of this, put the guy over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Kind of the same deal with him and Goldberg, where Hogan did that under the assumption he would get his win back over Goldberg. Another time didn't get his win back.
No.
Did it with Warrior as well, and he had to fucking bring him into WCW 8 years later to get that win back.
Oh, man.
You think that, well, it sounds crazy,
listen,
but this is,
hey, listen,
this is a wrestler's clique.
Hulk Hogan and Brock Lesnar are still both in the industry, and Hulk Hogan is only a ripe 60 years old.
Oh,
so,
God.
Never
Imagine
say never.
Getting up for that F5 today.
Yeah.
God, that was only 11 years ago. A young, spry 49-year-old Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, that kind of sets up where the WWE was at the summer, you know, mm-hmm. trying to create stars. One other story I remember from this was they were still flipping guys back and forth. But Jericho was one of them. He was drafted to SmackDown, and I mean, we mentioned all the workers on that show, and then they moved him over to Raw, and he did this interview, and the Detroit Red Wings had just won the Stanley Cup that year, and they asked him, like, moving to Raw, kind of what are the differences? He's like, well, to put it as a hockey comparison, it's like I was on the Detroit Red Wings, and I've been traded to the Columbus Blue Jackets.
Oh, man.
We're not in the playoffs out here. what a ballsy comment to make.
Yeah.
And, well, he got a concert tonight on this show as doing a Fozzy. I guess their first time ever performing on Raw, I would guess.
I think their only time.
They did it, remember, him and Cena when they did the rap and... I remember when they did a SummerSlam match, they did some, like, Battle of the Bands or some deal on Raw once.
And they had Fozzy, the whole band out.
Yeah, yeah. Know. Even the guy with the pig mask who introduces him. So there you go. We'll get into Raw now. Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, as Wei mentioned, set up by the entrance. And they plugged that tonight's main event, The Rock and Triple H, in a non-title match going into SummerSlam. The Undertaker comes out to start the show. He was still the biker gimmick here at this point, but the babyface biker says he has never made his political opinions public, but says, I don't take no shit. Just like America don't take no shit, in reference to his feud with the Un-Americans. And this starts a USA chant and says he is proud not only to be an American, he's proud to be a man. I'm proud to be a man. With a penis. And those un-Americans, they're gonna feel the wrath of my shit.
Yes.
That was pretty much his promo here.
He says he can
do whatever he wants as an American and back them up with his soup bones.
You can be, like, he specifically says, you could be a fire-breathing tattooed biker. which you can't do anywhere else but America.
He's not afraid to pledge allegiance to the flag and says he's going to make an example of Test on Sunday at SummerSlam, and he's going to find out what happens when you screw with America. I don't know if I enjoy a politically motivated, right-leaning Mark Calloway character here. Very much departure from the man that locked up people in body bags without repercussion.
I found him so obnoxious as this biker.
Is that as a wrestling fan or as a non-American?
I guess it's a bit of both.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like even as an American, I find this guy obnoxious. I mean, this was a very typical America, fuck yeah promo. That was, you know,
He was a post 9/11 babyface.
Exactly, an attitude quite
fuck with us. We're gonna beat the shit out of you.
Quite prevalent at this time.
How dare you have a different opinion than me?
Yeah.
Anyway, this was on the version that one of our listeners uploaded. This was from Sky Sports in the UK, so they didn't censor out shit.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a freedom.
You don't take no shit. It'd be... what?
How ironic is it?
I know, if they had censored the guy talking about the freedoms of America to say what they want. And they would have censored out one of the words.
I mean, in America, they would have censored that.
I know. It would have been censored over here, so that's kind of funny. So then his theme music starts playing, and Test comes out on a motorcycle, mocking Taker. He's got the American flag upside down, which is the sign of distress.
Yeah.
And gets into the ring. What do you want to share?
No, I was going to say, instead of a Harley Davidson, Test was riding, like, this Kawasaki crotch rocket.
Well, of course. Can't come in with an American bike here.
Yeah, that's right. He's got to come in with a Japanese bike. Yeah.
So he gets into the ring, takes the microphone from Taker, says, America and you suck. And that was it. And Taker just attacks him. Lance Storm and Christian run in, followed by Booker T and Goldust. They brawl, clear the ring of the Un-Americans. And Booker T says that SummerSlam starts tonight and challenges them to a six-man tag.
The Un-American stable, I think, is largely forgotten in pro wrestling history, and rightly so. It was...
They had some potential, but...
No, I mean, okay, maybe. Maybe for a guy like Lance, it was something good. But for guys like Christian, I thought it kind of totally made a guy like Christian completely lost. It's just such a... Even at the time, it felt like such a cliche to just have these guys who aren't American citizens. And so they... Like, they just never really seem to have any real type of motivation besides, you know, they're all Canadians. And then Regal joined them for a bit, too. There's no depth to it.
Then after the break, there are just a bunch of guys in the ring. Jeff Hardy enters, and then Eric Bischoff comes out and explains that everyone in the ring has won the hardcore title in the past, and the 24/7 rule is done. It's over.
I can't believe it took that long.
I can't believe this is the show that it happened.
It was like two, three years.
Yeah. So comes to an end. And says that they have 6 minutes to have a match, and the final person that's holding the title after this match stays the hardcore champion, and then just tells them you can fight wherever you want, except here, as he looks right by the ramp where there's this tarp overneath something. What could it be? And Terry Runnels is one of the people in the ring who won the hardcore title. She is on the lineage.
Oh, wow.
Just runs away from the ring as the match starts. And we had Jeff Hardy, Bradshaw, Tommy Dreamer, who was the reigning hardcore champion, Bubba Ray Dudley, Crash Holly, Spike Dudley, Steven Richards, and Johnny the Bull Stamboli. What a collection of guys here.
There's a guy who just, I couldn't tell who this was.
I know, it was... Johnny the Bull, right?
No, it was Steven Richards.
Oh, okay.
Because he didn't even look like Steven Richards. He had short hair at this time, was wearing like these blue track pants.
Weird pants, yeah, like these like indie-looking pants. Bradshaw pinned Dreamer like 30 seconds into the match. Bradshaw hit them with a bunch of cookie sheets to everyone, pulls out the kitchen sink, which allowed for the, he's even got the kitchen sink. There was a big chant for tables. Holly leaps off the apron and pins Bradshaw. Then Stamboli gets shoved off the top to the floor by Bubba. Hardy leaps off the back of Bubba to hit Stamboli on the floor. Bubba powerbombs Crash through the table. Bubba eventually pins Holly at 3 minutes and 44 seconds. Just a bunch of, hardcore spots. Tons of stuff missed here by the cameras because so much was going on. There was a cookie sheet shot to Bubba, who then lands on Dreamer, but Bradshaw moves him for the pin attempt. Then Spike breaks it up. Both are going for falls. They can't pin Dreamer in the time. So Dreamer keeps the title after 6 minutes. And this was all to set up Kane's pyro going off and this dramatic music teasing his return, as Kane was out with an injury at this point and was getting set for his biggest feud ever when he would come back with Triple H.
Yes, wow.
Later that fall, memorable feud.
Yeah.
So this was the end of the 24/7 rule, Way, and what an ode to the hardcore division. It took me all of 3 seconds to not miss this hardcore division during this match.
This was just an awful era of, quote-unquote...
Sloppy hardcore.
Hardcore wrestling. This was like this was the WWE's idea of what made ECW popular. It was just, they thought it was guys hitting each other over the head with cookie sheets and funny objects, when it was way more than that. It was much more about emotional storytelling, and these matches had none of that.
You weren't invested in Johnny the Bull Stamboli?
No, I was not. I mean, it's just a bunch of shitty hitting each other over the head with home hardware tools. With no drama, everybody overusing their finishes, getting a bunch of pins in to no dramatic effect. It just sucked. It was just a mess. And I don't think this hardcore title even existed too long after this.
They actually eliminated it the following week.
Oh.
They merged it with, I think, the Intercontinental title.
Yeah.
This was also during the draft. They couldn't help themselves with breaking up a bunch of tag teams with the Acolytes, the APA being one, as they did want to push Bradshaw at the time as a singles babyface, but also the Dudley Boys, who, I mean, we've talked about at this time, 11 years ago, just a gigantic failure, and they quickly paired them back up together.
They had Reverend Devon as a heel.
Coming up on SmackDown next week.
That's right. And also Bubba Ray Dudley, who was pretty much just playing... his typical Dudley
wore like a basketball jersey and like black track pants.
Terrible look.
Looked terrible.
I'm not going to say like Bubba Ray Dudley has ever looked good as anything, But back then,
yeah, today he's in shape.
He looks fine. Yeah, he looks good. Like in the Aces and Eights gear, fine. But you know, back then, wearing this oversized jersey of big fat guy who didn't really have anything, I don't know, attention grabbing about his character at all, other than the fact, like, you know, you break up the Dudleys, you take away the 3D, and that was essentially what got these guys over at the
totally
at the time.
Floundered as singles performers. And yeah, the gear on Bubba, he was a. He was my Tetsuya Naito for WH Park.
Oh,
out there.
Wow.
Just, I hated this guy's gear. I couldn't even take him seriously. Like, he looked like a guy out of the crowd.
The other thing, I mean, I will say the one split that did seem to work was Jeff Hardy and Matt Hardy. Jeff Hardy.
With Matt having the upside at the time.
Yeah.
Jeff was a mess here.
Jeff, you know, had some good matches too. You know, like that ladder match with Taker was quite memorable. And at least, I would say that the fans were definitely, into him as a single star, and Matt Hardy as well, of course. With that
I thought
run.
By 2003, I thought Jeff was done. I thought he was just—he had become so sloppy and just seemed like injuries had just destroyed him. So he was one of the big shocks to me that he would turn his career around, because 2003, I mean, they wanted to send him to rehab, he wouldn't go, and they released him. Like, he really just fell off the rails shortly afterwards. And Matt Hardy was suddenly became very nice. Matt Hardy was the standout at this time. So there you go, the hardcore title. One more week to go. Then we go into Eric Bischoff's office, and Trish Stratus and Stacy Keibler have been summoned to Bischoff's office. And they argue over who deserves the women's title shot. Molly Holly was the champion at the time. And Stratus thinks that Keibler wants to screw Eric. And Eric, meanwhile, walks in, listening to all of this. And Keibler says, "Wait a minute, aren't you the one that barked like a dog?" To
ooh.
The angle that will forever follow Trish around.
Yeah, I think so.
As much as her career diversifies. Bischoff walks in and says, "You two are here for one reason. Sex appeal. No one cares about women's wrestling. They want you to take your clothes off." So proposes that the two tonight have a bra and panties match in the mud. What? This might be the lowest of low points. If you're a male watching this, like, I just felt like, my God, this is what they think of the audience and what they want. And I'm sure there's a high percentage that were like, fuck yeah, put him in the mud. But I watched this and I just felt embarrassed to be a wrestling fan at this segment. I know Bischoff is a heel here, but this was like, my God. No one cares about you two wrestling. They want you guys to get naked and get in some mud.
Yeah, I mean, I totally understand that, but I wouldn't say that this would be the moment that made me feel that way. I feel like there have been way more. Like, I mean, just the dog barking.
Yeah,
Trish, that was pretty
there's
bad.
No shortage of candidates for that rock bottom moment of women's wrestling in the WWE.
This, I felt, was just like, okay, it's another wrestling women's angle.
It was just hilarious to see, like, where the women's division would be, like, a year or two later after this, where this was such a departure from this era, and especially with Trish being such a big part of that, that this is where she was kind of slotted in 2002. Mm-hmm. Mud matches. Howard Finkel, who was on camera here, introduced the women, and he was kind of doing the heel announcer gimmick at the time, feuding with Lillian Garcia. An awesome feud. So we got the bra and panties mud match was next.
It was really funny to hear Howard Finkel announce this match.
Up next, a bra and panties mud match. Keibler attacks Trish on the ramp and throws her off the ramp into the mud.
This was a major dive.
You could have blown a knee out here in a mud match.
Like, what padding is there in that pool of mud? I mean,
can't imagine anything. You're falling onto concrete, which is what this is on top of.
Yeah, this pool, like, it was really just a puddle of mud. Like, there's really no cushioning there whatsoever.
And so Trish, it was a huge group at the time.
That's right. Very good. And Trish, of course, like, really just took this bump off of this ramp. The stage onto the floor.
I think they put this into, like, the opening Raw signature at the top. I think this was put in there with Trish flying off the ramp into mud.
Yeah.
That was about it. Then they just messed around here in this mud match. I just looked down at, like, what am I watching here? This is one of those, this is kind of my job, and I don't understand how this is happening. The referee gets knocked into the mud as they fight. They started to spank one another. Trish chopped Keebler, who falls out of the mud pit. There is a roll-up on the floor where Trish gets the win and then tosses Keebler and Howard Finkel into the mud. And then Keebler slaps Howard, and Howard would have to call the rest of the show drenched in mud, as he was in the Jim Ross role in 2002.
Yes.
I'm just being embarrassed for everyone else's amazement.
They had Jim Ross for that, too.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. He was kissing some ass at this point.
I wonder what they actually used that looked like mud.
I don't know, but I can't imagine that these women didn't need, like, their eyes flushed out after this. Because there was one where Keebler grabbed her from behind, and Trish had, like, this wide-eyed look, and then, boom, got planted into the mud. It's like you had to get all this shit in your eyes and stuff like this, and not to mention in your hair and all this. Like, what an uncomfortable match to take part in.
Yeah, it's the job.
Then you walk into the back and you're drenched in mud while you're in a bikini.
It got to the point where, like, I couldn't tell which girl was who.
Because, it was very hard to tell
because they were all completely covered in this, like, thick.
This was worse than the Usos.
Yeah, it looked like I'm guessing like some type of chocolate mousse. Perhaps?
I don't know. Maybe you could. We should have done some research on what... that would have been a question for Corderas.
Yeah.
I'm going to find out. I'll find out, folks.
You should ask Trish. But,
Hey, Trish.
Well, yeah.
When you had your bra and panties mud match...
Yeah. I thought this was fun, harmless stuff, though. I mean, it was just TV.
Yeah, it was just TV.
Yeah.
The Rock arrives, and he is approached by one of the production assistants who has received a package from Paul Heyman. And Rock asks, is it Viagra, Rogaine, or maybe Ass Fetish Weekly magazine? And starts introducing himself to the PA and starts hitting on her. And this was usually whenever The Rock would disappear and he'd come back, he'd always have some new tricks up his sleeve of what he would do. Like, he'd have a new t-shirt, he'd have some new catchphrases. And during this 2002 period, he had this deal where he lost control of his leg, and his leg would start vibrating and going off, and he'd have to get the leg to, like, stop. And I guess it was like his leg was starting to jerk off his dick. Like, that's the best, because he was reacting to this woman here, and he's like, sorry, this guy's got a mind of its own. Easy there, boy. Anyway, he opens the package, and it's bloody pictures of Hulk Hogan that had been sent to The Rock.
Yeah. This was definitely the annoying babyface Rock with all the... It was really John Cena-level type of comedy, but with way better delivery. I wasn't a fan, though.
Tons better delivery, and I think it also... There were so many people watching The Rock at this time that would, when they came into wrestling later as writers... This was like their blueprint of a great character. And it's like, you got to be able to do comedy like The Rock.
I don't know.
And I think Rock was the exception.
I don't know. Because, like, The Rock has had some very, actually genuinely very entertaining moments throughout his career. This, I would say, would be one of his lower points where he was, I thought, very much relying on his superstar status.
But this stuff did get over with. People popped for this
stuff. I know.
Stuff.
And
as
I never,
cheesy as it is.
I think it got over because they regarded him as this movie star who, you know, had a great past. But I think the fans would eventually turn on him, too. You remember that Raw, 10-year anniversary deal that they did soon afterwards?
Yep.
Doing the same type of stuff, and it did not get over at all. So I thought even at this point it was starting to wear thin. It was just like he was delivering his promos in a style where, like, the pace was just all over the place, like he was on some type of, like, caffeine high.
He could have been. Maybe he drank a lot of coffee.
Yeah.
Jerry Lawler says, the last match we just saw with Trish and Stacy Keibler was one of the best he has ever seen. And then he is holding up the new edition of Raw magazine with Trish Stratus on the front cover. And then says that the pages are a bit sticky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what does that mean?
I guess that he jerked off to this Raw magazine.
Really?
Yeah. The pages are sticky. Yeah. One of the creepier Jerry Lawler moments.
He's got to do what he has to do.
What else screams, boy, I got to go get that Raw magazine If Jerry Lawler is taking this into a stall in the bathroom, then my God, I need to get my hands on this. What are those pictures like in that magazine? God. Triple H comes out sporting this salmon shirt, and he has papers, and says that 9 times out of 10 it's business in the ring, but this time with Shawn Michaels, it's personal. And he sent a contract to Shawn Michaels, who is going to return to the WWE on Sunday, but threatens to cancel their match unless Michael signed these papers because he does not want to be held responsible for crippling Shawn, which he is going to do on Sunday. He is called an asshole by the crowd. He says that he expects Brock Lesnar to be watching tonight's main event with The Rock, the two greatest franchise players, and it's going to be a no DQ match, and he's going to leave just enough for Brock Lesnar for Sunday. And he'll be awaiting Brock Lesnar next Monday on Raw when Brock is the new WWE champion.
We should talk about how this whole build started. And, you know, of course, Triple H was a babyface coming out of WrestleMania that year, having won the title match against Jericho. He had that brief run with the title before dropping it to Hogan.
Yep.
Was it? And then, you know, was a babyface all throughout and then came back to Raw. At this point, the NWO was still around, and they had, for some reason, brought in Shawn Michaels.
It was so weird. It's like, you probably don't even remember this version.
Shawn Michaels with an NWO shirt.
And with that, the hat he used to have.
The cowboy hat.
It wasn't even a cowboy hat. It was like one of those, I don't even know what they're called.
What? It was like a beanie? Like a skull cap?
Not a bee. I'll try and find a picture of it.
Tell me what hat Shawn Michaels was wearing when he was part of the NWO. But anyway, Nash tore his quad, and of course they disbanded the NWO. But that wasn't, you know, what came immediately after, though. Oh, it's the
Tangle hat.
Yeah, the Samuel L. Jackson.
I was going to say Samuel L. Jackson, but I thought that's too... look at this goof. He is by far the worst dressed wrestler in the history of wrestling.
Yeah. Anyway, so how this angle started was one of the best moments, I thought, in Raw history. It was Hunter and Shawn in the back, and Hunter's just like, you know, maybe we should do this. Maybe we should, you know, get back together and then do this. And then so they came back to Raw, and then the DX music hits. And then
people are just going nuts.
People went nuts. They came out, Hunter and Shawn, dressed in their DX shirts, Break It Down, Titantron, everything, posed for the fans. And then Hunter grabs the mic, gets ready to do his, you know, for those, you know, the whole
catchphrase.
And as he goes like, let's get ready to, and then he turns around to Shawn, kick, pedigree, knocks him out.
It was great.
And that was that.
What made it so great was, I don't think too many people necessarily saw it coming, and second, they wanted the DX reunion so badly. So much to relive DX that when Hunter took it away from them, I thought it was just great.
And you remember, this was way before they actually did reform DX.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
At this point, if they did it, I'd be like, no, thank you, no more DX. But at that time, you know, Shawn had been away for 4 years, and, you know, the memories of DX were still very good. But just the fact that they went through the trouble of, you know, making a brand new Titantron for that screen, doing all that stuff they did, and to tease us into thinking that this would happen, and then to have it turn immediately, I thought it worked great. And so Hunter turned heel at that point, which leads us to this match.
Yeah, and also put Shawn Michaels' head through a limo window.
Oh, he did that too.
Yeah, and then they had the miracle technology to unscramble Hunter's face on the security footage, and it revealed Hunter as the assailant.
Oh, that's right.
Michaels got hit from behind. He couldn't tell who it was.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but like at this point, what were your expectations going in for a Shawn Michaels match?
Oh, I thought they were extremely low. Yeah. I was at the point where I was like, man, I hope they can just gut through a match and it's passable.
Yeah.
Because Michaels, he
retired.
He finished at WrestleMania 14. He did one match, I believe, for his promotion out of Texas. I think he did one like singles match that was very basic and nothing memorable. But other than that, hadn't had a match since 98. So I think like his back was like he was told he would never wrestle again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that at the time, tons of people were expecting like this guy could really hurt himself. I remember this match and Kurt Angle going into the Lesnar WrestleMania match were matches where I was like, man, this guy could really fuck himself up in this match.
Yeah.
I never in a million years would have predicted Michaels would have had the return that he did.
Yeah, nobody did. Yes. And they were definitely playing on those expectations because Michaels was selling that back very hard on this show.
Yeah, yeah. Like, and we'll talk about the match in 2 weeks. But that set it up. Before the interruption here, I thought this Triple H promo just dragged, though, quite a lot.
As did many Triple H promos of his entire career.
This was like 6 minutes, and it felt like 20.
Yeah,
it was just really dragged for me. Chris Jericho then interrupted him with a Fozzy shirt, and Jericho, a heel at the time, was going to be taking on Ric Flair at the pay-per-view, and has a concert later tonight. Hunter brings up the fact that he beat him at WrestleMania, and Jericho calls him Hunter Hearst Hilarious. Both guys hate each other. But they are. Jericho says they're both facing old, washed-up has-beens at SummerSlam. This starts a Fozzy sucks chant, which Jericho years later would talk about the fact that, you know, being a heel and doing this stuff on WWE really didn't benefit his band when they would get heel heat on the band. And then Jericho says he has an easier opponent than Triple H at SummerSlam, who is less talented, less charismatic than him, and he is the king of the world. And it ends with Flair coming out and attacks him with a garbage can, putting it on top of Jericho as he falls over on the ramp, trapped in the garbage can. I thought that this entire segment was the low point of the show. I thought Hunter's promo dragged, and I thought Jericho's was pretty terrible, too. I had no interest in this Flair match after this.
I wasn't a fan of Jericho's screaming promo
either. I didn't
like
it at all. I didn't like this Jericho at all. He was like goofy mid-card comedy heel.
Yeah, and was this Flair's first match, or did he... Oh, actually, no, he wrestled Hogan.
Yeah, too, yeah, right? He had a bunch of matches at this point. Yeah.
And again, I think it's kind of striking to me, coming off of last week's review, to see all these guys from WCW in the company just short...
a year after, it would have been so much more impactful.
Man, you had Bischoff, you had Flair, you know, the NWO had their run, a whole bunch of other guys. So.
Yeah, a year too late. Then we had our six-man, Booker T, Goldust, and The Undertaker, the Texans, against Test, Lance Storm, and Christian.
Oh, they're all Texans.
Yeah.
Nice.
The Undertaker came out, and his key read The Undertaker, and below it, Undertaker.com.
Wow.
What an awesome website that must have been. Yeah, when everyone just had websites.
Is that still around?
I don't know. Look up Undertaker.com. Right. See if it what it redirects to. The babyfaces go after them on the aisle. Booker T hits a flapjack to Christian.
Just redirects to WWE.
Oh. Yeah. Still have it registered, though.
Like, how weird do you think it'll be, you know, 10 years from now when you watch an old wrestling show and all you see are, like, these at things and then these hashtags?
Yeah, be like, oh, my God.
What the fuck are these?
We were so stupid back in 2013. Mm-hmm. Twitter turned out to be this gigantic virus that trapped all your thinkings and thoughts and... put you in some intergalactic prison.
Okay.
That's where we're going to go.
All right, nice.
Google will be behind it. Christian got onto Booker's back. A lot of illegal blows here to the back of Booker's head. Test hit a pump handle slam. Taker makes a save. Booker T hit a drop kick to Test. Eventually made a hot tag to Goldust. Crowd was definitely into the match. Goldust then set up Christian in the corner for the Golden Globes, which was a running kick to the nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Golden Globes. Very clever.
I like it.
But Storm gets in the way. Taker sends him to the floor, and then Goldust kicks Christian. Walks into a big boot from Test. Taker comes back in with the snake eyes and a big boot to Test. Clotheslines him to the floor. Choke slams Lance, but then gets pulled to the floor with Test, and they brawl up the ramp. Goldust is the legal man, takes a belt shot from Christian behind the referee's back, and Christian pins Goldust at 6 minutes and 15 seconds. And Ross just calls them sons of bitches, and they're going to pay at SummerSlam, and ends just with, damn them! Damn them! Damn them for not believing in my way of life! These un-Americans. Ross was impassioned here.
Yeah.
Rock and Lesnar then... throughout this build-up for the main event, they did these awesome, like, sports-style vignettes building up the main event. And this video was Rock talking about wanting to be the best, breaking down Lesnar, talks about how to beat Lesnar, he's going to have to focus on speed, agility, and power and put them all into one. And he talks about how he's helped his speed by jumping hurdles, this shuttle drill, and then they would cut his training with stuff inside of the ring like running the ropes and how he's helped his side-to-side lateral movement and running the steps at the Orange Bowl, doing box jumps, weightlifting, his favorite being the clean and jerk. And then he talks about how he's holding these towels to do chin-ups and how it helps his grip strength. So what is the example they use? Shaking hands with Hulk Hogan and pulling him back to emphasize his grip strength. This was so awesome.
Yeah.
A handshake.
Yeah.
Just awesome. I thought this was a tremendous piece.
I really liked it. I'm a big fan of treating a pro wrestling fight like it's a real fight. Like a real athletic endeavor. And this was cool. This was also a much slimmer Raw.
Oh, yeah. He was definitely more toned at this point.
Yeah.
So just a tremendous piece. And I really feel that these vignettes that they aired each week for Lesnar and Rock, I think that they don't get their due for being a big part of the draw to that match.
Sure.
Because SummerSlam did very well that year in 2002 when business was overall pretty much down in 2002. Eric Bischoff is with Rob Van Dam in the back and tells him how important it is for RVD to beat Chris Benoit to bring the Intercontinental title back to Raw on Sunday night. And the Big Show walks in, wants to know why he isn't getting the IC title shot, and RVD calls him a tool, a giant tool, and he wants a match with Van Dam, and then the winner can face Benoit on Sunday. Bischoff says that Van Dam has a rematch clause, and that's why he gets the match, and he wants Van Dam fresh for Sunday. Van Dam says he wants a warm-up match so he's not stiff for Sunday, and they make the match for later tonight. Big Show and Rob Van Dam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, familiar faces that we still see.
A lot of familiar faces, yes. Terry is with Ric Flair, who says he had a major announcement to make 3 weeks ago, but he's put it on hold.
What was that?
I guess maybe a retirement tease, I think, was what they were going to tease with Flair back in 2002.
And did they drop it after?
Yeah, they just never went to it. He just kept wrestling.
So why even bring it up in this interview?
It's on hold. They're saying it's on hold, and it was on hold till 2008.
All right.
He says he's all focused on Chris Jericho and then gets attacked by a garbage can shot by Chris Jericho, who busts him open. And we should have known with Ric Flair, the consummate worker wearing the white shirt to really emphasize the blood as it got all up in his hair and onto his shirt.
He barely, like, grazed him, and then all of a sudden all this blood just started to appear.
He's an easy bleeder.
He's thin skin. Yeah.
Got Rob Van Dam and Big Show. To emphasize the brand split and how separate they were, Ross plugs tomorrow night live WWE action in Fayetteville featuring The Rock without noting that it's the SmackDown taping.
Oh, is that right?
They purposely put up a WWE logo and said live event. They would not plug that it was SmackDown.
Kind of detrimental to...
Yeah, I think in these cases it was like, okay, let's not be crazy here. We know what it is and what it isn't, but you want to... Yeah. I guess the idea that The Rock being there, it should be the advertising, the focal point, and we can leave out SmackDown.
I guess so.
But anyway, they were serious about it at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Howard Finkel, they just show him announcing the show here in this dry mud. This poor guy. Van Dam drop kicks the left knee of Big Show, kicks off the corner. Show then misses the knee and hits the steps with it on the floor, then takes a spinning leg drop from Van Dam off of the apron, runs into the steel post back first, then Show throws the steps into the ring. Van Dam runs into a choke slam, and then Big Show lifts up the steps to drop them when Bischoff comes out and says, "What are you doing?" And he yells 3 minutes as Rosie and Jamal, 3 minute warning, run in to attack the Big Show for the DQ at 2:36. And they trap Big Show's legs with the steps as Jamal hits a splash off the top and leave the Big Show laying.
I like the 3 minute warning gimmick. I always did. They just, two big Samoans who came in with a lot of ferocity and would just, actually, many times, legitimately beat the shit out of the people that they were.
Oh, yeah. Attacking. Sometimes they really laid it in thick.
Yeah. But I thought it was a good gimmick that seemed to get these guys over at the time. I didn't realize that Rosie is actually the brother of Roman Reigns.
Yes. Yeah. Jonathan Coachman is with The Rock in the back. He says him and Hunter go way back. Both have beat each other. They were fighting as babies in the nursery and does an impression of Hunter. Then he put a rattle up Hunter's ass in the nursery.
Oh, God.
Then prior to that, they feuded in the colonial days, putting the Constitution up Triple H's ass. Then they also fought in the caveman days.
Ugh. This sucked, man.
Like, picture John Cena doing this. Like, this was bad with Rock doing it.
Yeah.
Coach has a video that was sent in from Paul Heyman, who was just busy sending in tons of material here to Raw. And Rock calls Heyman a fat walrus on the beach and expects this video to be him on the beach watching Brock train. And they go to a highlight video of Lesnar just killing guys. Lots of shakiness to emphasize Brock Lesnar being out of control. But just like
There's a shaking effect on the editing. They love this.
Coach says that there's a rumor that Heyman and Lesnar might be at Raw in the arena tonight. And Rock tells Lesnar to just bring it. Because until you do, you're just going to be the next big bitch.
Mm.
Which was a tagline that didn't take off.
No, not really. Again, I found Rock incredibly irritating in this promo. Just everything from his content to his delivery, which was full of energy, but like energy that just seemed too really wild and really uncontrolled. I don't know why. I don't know how he turned into this. Because prior to this, I thought he was very good. But this and after this, when he would have his brief heel run, I thought he did very well then too. But in this particular moment, I didn't like him at all.
Like there were certainly, I'm sure, like a number of people that were probably a bit older at the time watching this that maybe were tired of The Rock. But I mean, he was incredibly over. Like he these was, promos, yeah. People still loved them. In 2002.
But he could have said anything, and he would have still.
Well,
been
that
over.
Was the thing. He could say anything and get it over with his delivery.
Yeah, Brock. You know, doing a great job, and I think Brock's his main draw and his main abilities is just his physical charisma. I compare Brock of that time to today, though, and clearly this man has developed a much more confidence and aptitude in his speaking ability, as you saw this past Monday in that promo or last Thursday in that video segment. Whereas back then they really didn't let him speak at all.
Also, a man who has grown over the years.
Brock Lesnar?
I would say so.
He was always big.
He was big.
He looked about the same size, actually.
He looks extremely big right now.
He looks about the same, I'd say.
Triple H is in Bischoff's office, and if you didn't know this show was taking place in 2002, you got hit over the head with it here, because Bischoff informed him that Shawn Michaels has signed the contract and faxed it over to him. Picking up the little phone and...
Do people not use fax anymore, like for contracts?
Fax machines exist.
You can't... I don't think you can email a contract.
You Dropbox that shit now.
Yeah.
You
can just, you know, sure?
Sign it on your iPad signatures? And Dropbox it over. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
He says... Bischoff gives him the contract and then says... I'm really showing my ass for this one, which is a term I have never heard nor heard since. I'm really showing my ass for this one. And Triple H couldn't help but turn over to look at his ass and say, really? Because I can't tell from here.
Why don't you bend over?
Bischoff says he isn't sanctioning this match, and officially it will never happen. And Hunter says, but it will happen, and it's going to be the most brutal match ever. Michaels will be left crippled, and it's going to live in people's minds forever. They plug Fozzy's new album, Happenstance, where Jerry Lawler got in a Willie Nelson reference, which would be his first of many. Name any groups you've heard of Jerry Lawler for this next segment, because Fozzy is introduced by the dude in the pig mask to perform his new song, To Kill a Stranger, which featured pyro going off on the stage, which I wouldn't want going off if I was performing on this Raw stage. It's like, I would have jumped. And Lawler just starts talking over part of this. Not that I was necessarily complaining. This was like a good 4-minute song here that we got to sit through, where we got references to the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, Lawler yelling, "This is music," and getting... the reaction at the end of this song by everyone booing the heel performing his real album that is really on sale and that they're really trying to push. And Jericho thanks the crowd by saying that Norfolk sucks and they're going to play another song, and the crowd is just so upset at the idea of this band that's about to go on tour playing more than one song. This is quite the segment. But before they can play another song, Ric Flair attacks Jericho with a guitar. He looked like a maniac here because he was still all bloody from the attack earlier, destroys the speakers and the set, and the result was this horrible buzz going throughout the arena from hitting these speakers, and Jericho leaves through the crowd running away from Ric Flair.
Also, Ric Flair like had it was like smashing guitars.
Yeah.
He had this broken like smashed guitar that he decided at the end, I'm going to take this broken guitar and I'm going to smash it into the turnbuckle post on the outside.
Right, so by the cameraman.
He baseball bats this broken guitar into the post, and the actual body of the guitar flings, almost killing somebody in the crowd, knocks down a cameraman, and the director quickly cuts to the POV of the cameraman on the floor. But man, there could have been some serious accidents right there.
Yeah, the company and Fozzy, I think, lost some significant money on this segment.
He was crazy. I've always thought, I kind of like this song, but I thought Jericho sucked as a singer live. He just out of tune, didn't really have the power for it. I'm assuming he's way better now after doing it for 10 years, but at this point, it's some bad singing here.
If there was anything better than the heel performing a song and getting a heel reaction to that song, it was coming back as Ross and Lawler plugged that you can catch Fozzy live at the World this Friday night for a show. And Lawler says it's going to be bigger than Woodstock. It wasn't. They run down the SummerSlam card with this female voiceover. Really good video, I thought, just plugging all the matches for SummerSlam. A very deep card when you see all of these matches that they have set up from top to bottom, like loaded card. The Rock is in the locker room, and his cell phone rings, but he just leaves it ringing. And then they cut to Lesnar and Heyman coming through the crowd with Heyman on his cell phone, leaving a voicemail for The Rock, as Heyman has upgraded from the Zach Morris phone in his Dangerous Alliance days to a flip phone in 2002.
I wonder what, he's probably got an iPhone now.
Oh, yeah, now. Yeah. Bischoff comes down with security and warns Lesnar and Heyman, who have tickets, that if they do anything, they will be thrown out of the building. And security is pretty much latched onto these two at ringside for the next match, which is The Rock and Triple H in their no DQ match. And Ross says that they must have bought scalp seats because they've been sold out here in Norfolk for weeks. They have a stare down. Triple H does the just bring it sign and Rock attacks him. Lesnar was seated in front of a guy with a Monday Nitro shirt right behind him. Hunter is attacking the ribs of The Rock. There's an abdominal stretch applied. Security is just hovering here over Lesnar. Ross, I thought, was doing a great job of just selling SummerSlam. Like, this was like a kid getting ready for Christmas. It's like, this is going to be the biggest SummerSlam. And on Sunday, we are going to say that we have been waiting our lives for this show. It was like, fuck, here's my $29.95. Just bill me for this show. I just thought he was great here. Rock hits him with punches, an overhead suplex, spine buster, hits the people's elbow, gets a two count. Then a low blow is hit to The Rock, and then hits him with the steps on the floor. Lesnar stands up as Hunter grabs a sledgehammer, attacks the referee, and sends him to the floor. And this allows Shawn Michaels to run in and stop Hunter from hitting him with the sledgehammer. Lesnar gets onto the apron, but accidentally gets knocked off and by Michaels hitting him with a Sweet Chin Music, and Lesnar fucking flies here from taking this Sweet Chin Music. Like, just sells huge here.
Not only that, but watch Shawn Michaels after delivering the super kick. He immediately drops down to his knees, grabbing onto his back.
He's so great.
Like,
here,
giving the impression that, you know, this guy can't even do his own finisher without causing his back pain. So just laying the seeds in there to think that this guy, there's no way he can really pull off any type of match, and doing a great job at it.
The Rock hits Triple H with a Rock Bottom, but rather than pin him, the ref is out. He jumps onto the turnbuckle, staring down Lesnar, and then runs into the crowd after Lesnar. Hunter is then with security on the floor as Michaels leaps over the top. This was like this really sloppy plancha, but I thought that that was key. I thought that this guy should look all sloppy. It's like, this is going to be an ugly street fight with a guy that's been out for 4 years. And I thought it was a great visual of him just flying over the top, fighting Hunter. And they go off the air with this close-up of Michaels on the ramp. The match never had a finish to it. They went about 10 and a half minutes. But a really good close to really sell what were the top two matches for SummerSlam.
Yeah, I'll say so. And I'm more focused put in this on this episode on the Shawn Michaels and Triple H match, because you still had SmackDown for Lesnar and Rock. But I thought a great job building that energy, building that crowd really hot for that final shot of Shawn Michaels triumphant against Triple H. I think as a go-home show, I enjoyed it, especially for what they did with Triple H and Shawn Michaels.
So they sold you on watching this for free?
Yes.
Have you watched SummerSlam 2002?
I have, yeah.
You did. All right, so that was our thoughts on Raw. Good finish to the show. I wouldn't say any great matches on this show or anything like that, but by the end of it, did I want to see SummerSlam? Yes. I thought the last segment did a good job in that regard. So we'll head to your feedback now on the message board, and we start off with Gaurav from India. Undertaker's promo was awesome. I chuckled when Taker said, "I'm damn proud to be an American," and then JR added, "You're damn right you are. We all are." When Howard Finkel announced that the following match is a bra and panties in a mud match, my sister was in the room, and she heard the Fink. She asked me what the hell I was watching. Let's just say it was very uncomfortable to explain to her. It was hilarious to witness Lawler having orgasms on commentary every time he would see a diva. Good old perverted Jerry. Rock's backstage interview was hilarious, and you could clearly see Coachman trying hard not to laugh. Loved the build of Triple H, HBK, and I remember being very excited to watch that match in 2002. A fantastic sell by Lesnar off the Sweet Chin Music. I loved Bischoff as the GM. Best line from JR in the end was when he screamed, "4 years, my ass! Shawn Michaels is back!" I give this show 7 out of 10, and I want to ask you guys if you think there's a possibility of Bischoff ever returning to WWE in the future. I would say you never rule out stuff like that happening, but I think it would be unlikely at this point. Bischoff's got a big side production company that's really his main job at this point. He doesn't really need to go back to the WWE, nor would I see the WWE putting him in the Hall of Fame or anything like that. I don't know how much there is to really gain with Bischoff.
I could see them bring him back for like some TV, like some DVD stuff perhaps.
Yep.
But I think he's always been a very good on-air performer.
I think so, too.
I always feel like they could make use of a guy like that. We got a man from the UK who says, "I found it interesting that this show from 2002 was a more daring product than what we get in 2013. The best example of this was the Rock and Brock build, most notably the training vignette. I thought that it was awesome that they went in a more sports-based direction for this match, as it gave the big match feel that is rarely seen today. This got me wondering, why don't WWE go outside the box more when it comes to building their main event? Boxing and UFC do something really special with their various countdown shows, and it frustrates me that the WWE, with their resources and option to take more creative liberty, haven't incorporated an equivalent to their programming. Take this year's SummerSlam card, for instance. Am I alone in thinking a well-produced countdown special in the vein of UFC Primetime would be awesome? Maybe it's just me, but seeing Daniel Bryan training and speaking on his journey to the biggest match of his career would captivate me more than a corporate makeover."
I think that, you know, that kind of serious sports build, I think, you know, you don't want to do it every month, but I think every now and then it can really, people latch on to that. And I think that if you were to produce a countdown special, and I hate to use the comparison of Total Divas, but kind of in that kind of sense where you're following these people around, they're not scripted, it's kind of just, well, here's what we're pushing the WrestleMania match, and this is the storyline, and we're going to weave that into this countdown special.
They did try something like that with the first Rock and Cena match. You remember?
Yes.
Once in a Lifetime?
Yeah.
And I don't know how many people even ended up watching that. I didn't really like that either. I didn't think it was that great. It was just like a lot of it, unfortunately, when it comes to wrestling, you don't really see these guys training. It's just like a lot of it's focused on, them doing media appearances and whatnot.
Yeah. TNA, a few years ago for Bound for Glory, I think it was 2009, they did like a countdown special, and I thought it was way better than the Once in a Lifetime. And I think it was like three or four matches they focused upon and kind of having them with different storylines. And I recall it being pretty strong at the time.
The other issue is, like, you already have so much TV. How are you going to get people to you know, invest another hour into a countdown show?
Yeah.
When, you know, theoretically...
Well, that's never been... That's never hindered them.
But when, theoretically, your TV should be your countdown show.
Yep. Chris in China. I love early 2000s WWE. I've watched WWE on and off again since 97, but I really got into wrestling in 2002. I'd almost forgotten that JR and King sat on the opposite end of the announce table than normal, and this was one of a multitude of things that made SmackDown and Raw feel like a truly different show back then. We will see that for sure come next week's review. Here are some things I noted. Hearing Taker say shit was surprising. I liked his promo, but I prefer the later Dead Man character. WWF advertisement spot in the middle of a show was kind of funny. Do you think WWE got in any kind of trouble for that? I don't understand that. What a way to abolish the 24/7 hardcore title rule with the predecessor to the championship scramble match. I had no clue Dreamer was even performing in WWE at this time. Was this when he had that gimmick of proving he was a tough guy by eating dog food and drinking Taker's tobacco spit? Yes, this was his run of eating stuff. God, Bischoff was really shooting about WWE's view on women's wrestling in that backstage segment. Rock, Brock, and Triple H HBK were the two rivalries that really got me hooked into becoming a true fan. I wish we could see a lot more of that from WWE. It's been said before, but it's jarring that we have a matchup that can be just as big as these two noted rivalries with Cena and Bryan, yet we are subjected to the usual 2005 to present day usual McMahon horseshit. I give Raw 7.5 out of 10. It wasn't perfect, but it was a shining example of what WWE still should be today, in some cases at least.
Mike from Caledon. I always loved the opening Raw video. It made my week. It was depressing when they got rid of it. Decent Taker promo, good but not his best. Kind of came across as a heel. Maybe it's just me being Canadian, but I always found Americans to be the heels in the Canada versus US feud. The Divas promo said it best. No one cares about women's wrestling aside from a brief period later that year in Mickey versus Trish. I proceeded to take a bathroom break. The only thing this match did was that it allowed Uncle Jerry to have an orgasm on live TV. The main event was solid, but not the best Rock Triple H match I've ever seen. I didn't like the fact that Brock Lesnar basically got beat up by a man who had a broken back and hasn't competed in 4 years.
Up next, we go on over to Jacob from East Essex in merry old England. Hi, John and Wade, been a long time listener. Following the invasion angle, I, like many people, gave up on the product and so went blissfully unaware as this packed-out SummerSlam card passed me by. This Raw definitely left me feeling a bit like I should have stuck with it a bit more, as I feel I definitely missed out on a high period that occurred during the post-invasion period when they had a host of ex-WCW ECW talent at their disposal, alongside many of their mainstays still in their prime and a host of exciting up-and-coming talent. The main thing I took away from this Raw is how much I missed the show being 2 hours. Everything that occurred was at least vaguely relevant to the storylines they were pushing at the time, and there was nowhere near as much filler as today. I enjoy a 15-minute Tons of Funk 3MB match as much as the next guy, but still. Anyway, good Raw, with the exception of the post-9/11 all non-Americans are terrorist ideology they were pushing heavily. This in particular reminded me why I hated the American Badass character so much and did put a slight downer on what was otherwise, in my opinion, a very good go-home show for an exciting card. The fact itself that the headlining match on the show is one that is now 11 years later being touted as potential for a WrestleMania 30 headline, not one that I nor I can imagine anyone else wants to see, is still a big positive sign in itself, I feel. Not entirely sure what the intention was having Fozzy play as the heel tactic. The crowd seemed a little unsure whether they should be booing, but thankfully Jericho's pre-vocal coaching singing seemed to sway them. Wasn't a fan of The Rock's promo at all. Training video package shown prior made me far more interested in the match than the always hilarious walrus comments directed at Heyman. In fact, the show was probably a bit dense in the shitty promo department as a whole, Taker's being the standout. I took too much amusement from Lesnar wearing a SummerSlam shirt promoting his own match. I watched this whole thing pretty high, so that might have been why. No idea what the point of the Braun Panties mud wrestling match was, but Bischoff seemed very proud of himself on that one. Was a fan of the hardcore match, but I was always a giant mark for that title as a teenager. All in all, good show. Looking forward to checking out the SmackDown go-home show. Never thought I would say that.
Cody from Maine. Taker's overly patriotic promo to start the show was solid. Witnessing the monumental end of the 24/7 rule was heart-wrenching. The match was good for what it was, with it being highlighted by a table spot and unprotected cookie sheet attacks to the head. It was a bit tough to watch The Rock's parking lot promo here. Back then it certainly worked, but considering he still cuts the same promo today, I found it a bit more difficult to enjoy. However, his promo later on in the show was fantastic, and I wonder who in the WWE watched the show back then and had the idea to once once again call Paul Heyman a walrus. Triple H's promo was solid to start, but by the time Jericho came out, it had dragged on for way too long and lost its steam. Jericho, much like The Rock, cut pretty much the same promo we've seen in recent years, although I found this match much more enjoyable.
From Matt, I found... let's just skip here to how he got to watch this show. Some highlights include the reveal of Triple H being HBK's attacker, the debut of Mini Dust, The Undertaker stealing a police motorcycle to chase the un-American... Okay, what? This has nothing to do with the show. Anyway, let's go to the next one. Alexander Rios. I don't quite know how to label this show. Is it the Attitude Era? I don't know. But this early brand extension, post-NWO era of Raw, was damn compelling. Undertaker is the badass, giving a nice post-9/11 promo. Rock and Brock and Triple H Shawn, to me, are still some memorable builds because they were pretty straightforward. Rock was the champion, Brock wanted it, and was ready to plow him down to get it. Triple H was the asshole heel again that he was in 2000, but wearing an absolutely ridiculous shirt. And Shawn, putting aside the ridiculous short hair of this era and missing the entire Attitude Era, glad he came back to WWE to clean up his rep he had from the 90s. Does anyone know why JR and Lawler were sitting stage side as opposed to ringside? I had totally forgotten about that and never knew why. And of course, the Mud Wrestling Bra and Panties match, where the diving spot would be used on the Raw Open for years to come. Never again will we see that, at least during this PG era. And on a final note, I did some research, and unless I'm mistaken, this Raw was the very last time Triple H and Rock ever wrestled each other. Still love the show in this era, and give it 8.5 Triple H ridiculous pink shirts out of 10, Shawn Michaels early 2000s mullets. Okay, that was a mouthful.
Ronaldo from Milan, Italy. Eric Bischoff was a great GM, and I love how he made Raw his show, playing evil mastermind and toying with wrestlers. The Bra and Panties match was just that, a display of TNA, and God bless that, since yes, no one cares about women's wrestling, or at least not about WWE women's wrestling, so nothing wrong with that. I miss The Rock delivering awesome promos every week, and kind of feel sad for today's fans who only got to experience the rebooted Hollywood version for the past three WrestleManias. Great build-up to SummerSlam.
We go on over to Sean from New Jersey. Is it just me or did Undertaker's opening promo sound very familiar to a current-day Zeb Coulter anti-immigration promo? During this time period, I really enjoyed Bischoff as the Raw General Manager. Even in this episode, he was great. He had a great line in saying, "Nobody really cares about women's wrestling," right to the face of a future Hall of Famer. I completely forgot this Raw included the famous Bra and Panties Mud Match. The famous Bra and Panties Mud Match, where Trish takes a nasty bump off the stage into the mud pool. As for the rest of the show, Triple H had a boring promo, average six-man tag, a Fozzy concert expertly called by Jim Ross. At least the show had a pretty hot ending leading into the top two matches at SummerSlam, 6 Big Show burials out of 10. And that is going to wrap us up on this week's edition of Review Away. So that sets us up for next week, Way, where we are going to chat about SmackDown and see what the Thursday night show could produce to get you ready for SummerSlam.
Yeah, as I said, you know, stacked roster on SmackDown, probably the better show at that time. Of course, you had Brock Lesnar, you had Benoit, Eddie, Rey Mysterio.
And next week, we're going to get John Cena versus Batista.
Whoa. Seriously.
In a tag match.
The Deacon Batista?
He had just come out of the Deacon gimmick, and John Cena proudly wearing the colors of the North Carolina Tar Heels.
Oh, God.
As he would in every city he would go to. So if you want to see the up-and-comers, John Cena and Batista, that's going to be on next week's SmackDown, who had absolutely no connection to SummerSlam that year. They would both be watching that from the monitor backstage. So that's coming up next week. We'll post the show up, and you can leave your feedback. It's the August 22nd, 2002 edition, which was a WWE live event from Fayetteville, North Carolina, the night after Raw, featuring The Rock. So that's coming up next week, and then 2 weeks from this week, we will review SummerSlam 2002. So we're going to get on out of here. In the meantime, you can go to liveaudiowrestling.com, subscribe to all of our shows by checking out Live Audio Wrestling on iTunes, and we're going to be back later this week. The MMA report, as I'm going to be heading down to Boston for the UFC show this coming Saturday night, and Friday, it's going to be Wei Ting and Nate Milton handling Review and Impact, as Nate will be attending live, so down in Norfolk.
Norfolk.
That's it. What should we use to get on out of here, Wei? What song really summed up the era of 2002 for you? Anything that really struck you?
The era of 2002. The era of 2002?
Well, the year 2002. Is there anything relevant, maybe, that you want to hear right now?
Why don't we go out with this... This.
Oh, this song? You're really going to pick this?
Yeah. I love this back in 2002.
Wow. When this came out, I thought to myself, man, SummerSlam's coming up soon.
That's what I always think.
August 2002. What a song.
Yeah.
Let's hear the rest of it.
Chill out, what she yelling for? Lay back, it's all been done before. And if you could only let it be, you would see. I like you the way you are. When we're driving in your car and you're talking to me one-on-one, but you become somebody else around everyone else. You're watching your back like you can't relax. You're trying to be cool, you look like a fool to me. Tell me why you had to go and make things so complicated. I see the way you're acting like you're somebody else gets me frustrated. Like you're something else. Where you are and where it's at, you see, you're making me laugh out when you strike your pose. Take off all your preppy clothes. You know you're not fooling anyone when you become